Welcome to the Pet Industry Podcast, connecting you with the people behind the passion, the leading experts in the pet industry. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Sprinkle. When making a decision for our pets, their health and wellness is top of mind. Wanting healthy diets for pets, gut health is a popular claim that pet parents might seek and see on packaging. Despite a lot of strong-sounding claims on the market, there is a concerning lack of strong research going into the efficacy and recommended use of pet food ingredients, which is why we want to understand as much science and research as possible to make sure that pets truly are getting the health benefits stated on packaging. Today, we will talk with Dr. Mark Franklin and Lawrence Mills from Cargill about the uses and opportunities of postbiotics in pet food and the research behind them. Mark has over 25 years experience in animal nutrition, formulation, and product development. He has a BS, master's, and PhD in animal science. Mark is responsible for technical and customer support of Cargill's vast portfolio across multiple species. And the pet market in Europe, especially Western Europe, has some similarities to the U.S. market. And as BSM is going more and more global, we want to see the similar challenges and opportunities. Since Cargill is a huge global company, we thought it would be neat to get a few insights from a representative from Cargill EU and International, Lawrence Mills. So you will hear his perspective trickle throughout as well. Welcome. I'm very excited for this episode because this is a topic that I think internally we talk a lot about, and that's one, the importance of researching your products, because we are a bunch of scientists here at BSM and we do believe in the value of the research behind things. And then we're going to talk about a really hot topic, and that is around postbiotics. So understanding more of what they are and how they can benefit our pets. So I want to welcome our guest from Cargill, Mark Franklin. You have a long history in the animal science industry, and so you're very knowledgeable about these topics. You have a PhD in animal science. You've, like I said, worked in the pet industry for a long time and are currently the global technical sales lead for pet at Cargill. I would really like to start with understanding more about Cargill, because I was talking with a colleague not long ago, and it just kind of hit us how ginormous Cargill really is and all the different parts within Cargill. So do you mind sharing a little bit about Cargill and how Cargill became involved in the pet food industry specifically?
Yeah, certainly. Happy to, Megan. Thanks for the invite. Look forward to visiting with you today. Yeah, Cargill, as you referenced, a ginormous company, do lots of different things, looking at the human side, looking at the livestock side, and then focusing in specifically on the pet side, right? So Cargill's pet activities, I think, have just been a natural extenuation of some of the other business units. So including the human side, right? So we pull in insights from human, we pull in insights from production species, and translate that into our pet products. We've been doing it for quite a while, right? And so through some acquisitions over the years, we've been in this biotics, postbiotics area for 40 plus years on the pet side. Over 80 years, if you look at our endeavors across the entirety of the Cargill business.
So what's going on in Cargill Pet in Europe? Here is Lawrence Mills. He has over 20 years of experience in global animal health sector. He is the business development manager for the pet postbiotic ingredients for the EU and International.
Unlike other regions such as Asia and the Americas, Cargill is a relatively new ingredient player in the European pet channel. After launching our True Pet, which is the same as True Mune in the US, and Ethical Pets, around about 3 years ago when I started, we've now successfully established this pet postbiotic technology in the market. The other aspects is the other ingredients that we provide the European pet market, which is things like vitamin and mineral premixes. And we've got a range of oils, texturizers, plant proteins, sweeteners, and a limited range of byproducts.
So Cargill has a vast history and experience in pet products. But then I asked Mark to explain a little bit more about Cargill's background in fermentation to get to postbiotics.
Yeah, that history really goes back to the Diamond V organization, right? And so been doing these fermentations for over 80 years, really, really expertise in that. Controlling that fermentation, picking the right strains, making sure we feed the organisms the right way, and then harvesting those components out of that is really Cargill's bread and butter, right? So through the Diamond V acquisition, translating that, those products into that research and then being able to bring that to our customer base has really been one of Cargill's strong points.
Fantastic. And so in case some people are like, well, why did fermentation come up and what does this have to do with postbiotic? Let's talk a little bit more about defining these different biotics that we tend to talk about. I think there's a little bit more known around prebiotics. Those are more like our fibers. And then probiotics we talk a lot about. But do you mind sharing a little bit more about postbiotics and how they all work together?
Absolutely. Postbiotic, a relatively new term for us, right? So we've only had the postbiotic definition for a couple years. And it's funny, if you go back and look at some of our research and back at some of the papers, we actually refer to ourselves as a prebiotic, right? Just simply a naming convention, right? Just simply a naming convention now that we have postbiotics. But now that we have that definition, what is a postbiotic, right? And so by that definition, that postbiotic is an inanimate organism that confers a benefit on the host.
Lawrence also had a great way to explain postbiotics.
I would tend to describe it as the fermentation of prebiotics, which are considered the food, and probiotics, which are considered the factories. And it's then these metabolites that are then made inanimate to arrive at a postbiotic, which I consider the goods. And it's these metabolites that are now recognized in science as the drivers of health outcomes.
Looking at postbiotics a little more closely, Mark Franklin explains a little bit more about what this means for Cargill.
So at Cargill, we take that definition and we narrow that in even more. That narrowing in is really based around how we make our product. So it's a yeast, right? It's the Saccharomyces cerevisiae, big word, right? But it's a yeast organism. And we control that fermentation through the inputs, what we feed the yeast. Then we allow those yeast to ferment, to grow, and produce metabolites. We then harvest that, dry it down. That's where the inanimate comes from. So we're not talking like many people might be familiar on the probiotic side with a CFU count, colony forming unit count. That's not us. So we dry that down. We're inanimate. And we take everything. We take the yeast cells themselves. We take all the great stuff that the yeast made, the metabolites, and any of the media that the yeast hadn't got a chance to eat yet. We dry that down, and that's a postbiotic. Different from a probiotic, of course, because it's not a living organism. And different from, as you referenced, a prebiotic, because it's not a fiber source.
Exactly. And you started talking about that it's not a live organism, which is going to be part of the benefit that we'll talk about in a minute. So I think that's important Absolutely. To know. And when it comes to developing these postbiotics, I think now you and I, we've talked about these for a little while, but where did it start with thinking about developing postbiotics? As you said, it's a newer term. Is there a story behind the journey and the mission into why focus on postbiotics and seeing how we could use that for pets?
Yeah, absolutely. I think part of it is, as you referenced, some of the advantages of a postbiotic, right, and not being living. But backing up further and looking at that, sort of how that development came to be, we stumbled across a really interesting finding. So what we noticed in our production facilities is that our plant workers didn't take sick days. They don't report in sick. Now, okay, fine. Is that the environment they're in? Is that just happened to be the geographic location? But then when you looked at people that didn't work on the floor and worked in the office, they took more sick days. So there had to be something there. We start to investigate that and understand that, hey, it's the effect that postbiotics are having on ourselves, right, as humans. So then that spun off a whole bevy of research, a whole product line development. And if you look at that, one of our postbiotics, Epicor, on the human side, we've taken that and turned that into Epicor Pets. And so we've been doing the research on pets to dogs and cats to start to understand some of those benefits that we kind of just happened upon. Now, from the other side of the equation, knowing that at least on the livestock side, for many, many, many years, we've been driving those effects that we wanted to see on the livestock side. right? So digestibility and feed conversion and all of those things. Well, that's not how we look at stuff in pets, right? So not exactly the same parameters that we're after, but as we think about the influence that we're having on the microbiome, those bacteria that are in the gut microbiome, and the other microbiomes that exist, you know, on all of our bodies, skin and coat, oral microbiome, the gut-brain axis, how our gut affects our brain. We thought, wow, there's got to be something there for pets. So that really kicked off our endeavor to start looking at that species-specific research, not just translating stuff from the human side and our observations on the human side, but what does that do now for our dogs and cats? And so being able to really take that information down to our target species.
Yeah, I love that. Again, being a nutritionist and a scientist, getting very specific data on the species. We talk about that a lot too in science, because dogs and cats are not identical. We have a lot in common, but they're not identical to people and even to each other, right? We always say cats are not small dogs, right?
Right.
That they also have some differences too. So let's start with challenges. Did you find any challenges when it came to working with live microorganisms or anything in this process that you kind of were having to work through to get to the benefits that we can talk about?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so there are thousands of different strains, is the term that we use, of yeast. Thousands of different strains of even Saccharomyces cerevisiae. So the trick really becomes in picking the right one. By picking the right one and feeding that yeast in the right way to get the outcomes that we want, to get those metabolites that we want. So that's where Cargill's fermentation expertise really shines. Being able to do that, to pick the right strain, to feed that in the right way, to drive those metabolites that we're after. So that's some of the challenges, but it also presents a lot of opportunities. So you can imagine with thousands of different yeast strains, and that's just yeast, right? We're not even talking about all the bacterial strains that are available to us. Then that becomes an opportunity, sort of our library, if you will, if we need a new product or we have a new consumer need, or an owner says, hey, I've been having this kind of problem. What do you think about it? Is there anything that you could help me with? That lets us kind of go back to the library and start from scratch and say, okay, if we wanted to influence or work on this owner expressed issue, how would we do that? So both a challenge and an opportunity.
Yeah, that is interesting. And since you brought it up, if somebody was going to see this on a label, what would they see it show up on a like a pet food label?
That will show up as a yeast fermentate or a Saccharomyces cerevisiae fermentation product. We use the acronym SCFB because it's just lots easier to say. It's one of the challenges, right? And how that appears to on the label, because it's not super easily recognized by the customer, how we have to name these ingredients.
Yep, exactly. Which is why I wanted to talk about it too, because that way people at least know what to look for or will recognize it when they see it on the label, because the label is really hard to navigate sometimes. And you have to follow the guidelines of the AFCO to be able to put those on the label. And so it's not entirely in your control. You're following the rules. So thank you for sharing that a little bit. In case you're in Europe, the AFCO equivalent in Europe is FedEF. So Lawrence explains some slight labeling differences.
I do have to say, for both Europe and USA classifications, it's a real shame from my perspective that postbiotics remain listed under yeast products, as this really doesn't do justice to all the proven health benefits versus other yeast. In Europe, our pet postbiotics are registered as an EU feed material in the EU catalogue, not as an additive. But as for FedAV, then we're 100% aligned to their natural requirements. And I think the one differential between AVCO is on the ingredient panel in Europe, we're not restricted to an AVCO-style yeast culture description for our postbiotics. So we're also able to provide support to customers with pet parent on-pack messaging insights to leverage their investment in postbiotics.
also going back to some of these challenges, not only you had talked about some challenges working with all these different strains of yeast, but then comparing it back to probiotics, which are supposed to be live organisms, right? That's the goal, is to get them live into the body. There are some challenges working with them as well. So do you mind going into it a little bit when it comes to working with pet food and pet products? What are the challenges that we have to think about when it comes to using a probiotic, which needs to be live to work, versus what we've talked about where they don't have to be live and putting those into pet products?
Yeah, that's a great point, Megan. That challenge of processing pet food, right? There's a reason, right? There's a very good reason that we do that from a food safety point of view. So we want to produce safe food for our pets. And part of that is the processes that we use, right? So extrusion technology, temperatures, pressures. We look at retort, you know, on the wet side. Think of canning green beans on the stove, right? And so that preservation process to make our food microbiologically safe is not the friendliest to live organisms. And so probiotics have to go through all that and be able to survive, of course, to be a live organism, and then to have their effect. So not knocking probiotics at all, for sure, when we're able to do that, you know, the literature would tell us that they work. It's just that upstream processing challenge that probiotics have to go through that we really don't have to worry about with the postbiotics, right? So they still have their effect even after going through all these food safety processes.
Yes, and on the manufacturing side too, there are some ways and certain strains that we can try to use to help with survivability. But a lot of times you're having to put in a very large dose to get the end result. So that's a lot of money you're putting in with the expectation you're going to lose a bunch. I mean, again, thinking about a cost and manufacturing perspective, those are also big challenges as well. You know, on the formulator side, we're like, yay, we can have small dose. We know it's going to do its job at the end of all this and do the benefits that we're wanting anyway. So speaking of, let's talk about those benefits that you have found in your particular postbiotic products. I love the story of recognizing that the manufacturer workers were not getting sick. So it sounds like there could be some maybe immunity benefits, but I happen to know you've done a lot of research finding a lot of different benefits. So what are some of those and maybe some of your favorite ones?
Yeah, absolutely. Really talk about them in two or three buckets here of benefit space. Gut health, right? So what do we mean by gut health? We can go into that a little bit more. Definitely the immunity, as you mentioned, that immune response, but a balanced immune response, right? So I think it's important that we talk about a balanced immune response when we talk about that. And then really just looking at the microbiome effect of the certain populations that are in the intestine that we want versus those populations of bacteria or fungi or the others that we don't want. So focusing in, first of all, on that gut health, right? What are we after with gut health? We want, of course, good digestibilities. We want that intestine prepared to digest the food, to absorb the food as it's digested. One of the measures that we look at there is also what we reference as volatile fatty acid production, right? So these compounds serve as substrates for the intestinal cells themselves. So that intestinal cell health, and one of those particularly butyrate, right, is known to be like preferred by intestinal cells. So the work that we do is to make sure that we're influencing those populations that produce the butyrate to sort of feed the intestinal cell itself, right? Because without good intestinal cell health, then we run into issues, right? We run into decreased digestibilities. And it's a little difficult concept to understand, but imagine those intestinal cells lined up right next to each other, side by side. And so they're squished together. Well, that tight junction between those cells serves as a barrier property, right? It doesn't let stuff through. It doesn't let other bacteria through. It doesn't let other compounds through, but it serves as that barrier. In certain challenge situations, we know that barrier can not be as protective as it's supposed to be. When that happens, some of these bad guys get through, right? And can really affect the health of the animal. That intestinal tight junction, cell integrity, as part of the digestive health story, is some of the things that we've looked at with our research, knowing that we have a positive effect on that. Also interplayed with immunity. We've talked about immunity a little bit and the concept of a balanced immunity. We don't want an active immune system all the time, right? We want it when we're sick. We want it when we face a challenge, but it's a really biologically expensive process for us to be on the go all the time, for us to be geared up and that immune system triggered as if we're actively fighting an infection or a stress or a challenge. That's not what we're after when we talk about balanced immunity. What we really mean when we're talking about balanced immunity is we want those cells that sort of survey and keep watch over what's going on to be more ready to respond in case there's a challenge. And I use a little simple analogy. It's kind of like the 911 operator, right? 911 operator gets a call and there's a fire. Okay. How big's the fire? How many fire trucks do I need to send? Do I need to call a neighboring town? So these surveillance cells are what we want primed and ready so that when a challenge happens, they know what to call for, right? In my analogy, they know how many fire trucks to send to the fire. Is this 2 alarm or 5 alarm? And so through the research that we've done, we show positive effects on those surveillance cells so that when a challenge is experienced, we get a faster, more appropriate response. Because if you call it a 5 alarm fire and you send all those fire trucks, then you've wasted resources, right? You've overreacted to what's going on. We certainly don't want to underreact, but we want to be ready to appropriately respond to the challenge. And that's what our research has shown.
Yes, it makes me think of a smart immune system, right? We talk about our technology. We have dumb phones and smartphones. We need a smart immune system. So wonderful. And those, I think, are probably the bigger benefits that people think of. But the other thing that I really appreciated about the research that you did is that you actually discovered some benefits that were surprising. These were pet owner observations that you discovered. And do you mind sharing a little bit of that?
Yeah, happy to. So one of the research trials that we looked at was an in-home use test, right? And we know from some of the pet parent insight that we've done that pet parents really want to see, hey, I want to see the effect in my animal, right? I want to see what this does in my home, in my neighborhood, right? So we get after that a little bit with the in-home use test. So we did an in-home use test with one of our postbiotics, Epiphora in this case. And we asked owners a bunch of questions, right? We asked them, okay, what are you noticing about your dogs? This happened to be a dog study, right? What do you notice about your dog? How active are they? How much are they playing? What are the physical signs that you're seeing? And of course, we had two groups, right? A placebo group and then the Epicor group. And they were blind. They didn't know. We didn't know until after the study was over. And we had asked them questions around oral care, around breath odor. And owners reported back to us that they noticed a decreased breath odor in their dogs. Now, as a scientist, I'm always after that one more thing. What's the one more thing I could have looked at in a trial, right? That might unlock for me, you know, this increased level of understanding. We actually looked at gut microbiome, fecal microbiome in this trial, but we didn't look at oral microbiome. But we're still getting an owner-reported response of decreased breath odor. And so as we think about, okay, how could that work? So we certainly know that influencing the gut microbiome can influence other body systems, right? So what's this gut-oral microbiome connection that we might have that was expressing itself with owner-reported decrease in breath odor. So that was sort of an aha finding for us. You can imagine we're fascinated. That's one of the key consumer complaints, if you will. Oh, my dog breath stinks. It just really stinks. And then you listen to cat owners particularly, and I love wet food, right? I love wet food, but wet food can be a little more odoriferous, and cats eating wet food can have a little stronger breath. And hey, can we see this in cat, right? What's our next piece of research? As you can tell, I'm pretty excited about it. And we want to come at this from a research point of view, right? All the research that we embark on, we want to be published, right? We want to go through the peer review process. We want other scientists to take a look at that and say, yep, I agree, you did this right, or nope, don't agree, need to go back and try again. So that's how we design all of our research trials. But that one was pretty fascinating, that breath odor discovery.
I agree too, because I'm thinking about my own dog and wishing she had sometimes better breath. And especially I've been giving her a little bit of a wet topper on her food. And that is when her breath odor actually did get worse. Yes, I think just we can all share probably similar experiences with our own pets with that. And it just makes you think about where are all the applications that this could be? Could we put this in dental chews, or can we put these in other things to help with different problems that are very, very common for our pets?
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting that you mentioned that you're putting wet topper, right? Very, very common, right? Put a wet topper on a dry food, right? Typically, part of the reason that we do that is for palatability, right? We really want our dogs and cats to really eat the food and enjoy the food that they're eating. And throughout our research, that's one of the other things that we've also found, right? Really palatable. We just finished a cat piece of research where we showed a 4-to-1 preference, right? And 4-to-1 preference, you think, okay, that's pretty good. But then you look at the inclusion levels, right? And we're somewhere around 1%, right? Depending on the food, depending on the feeding guidelines, right? As you calculate that, somewhere around 1% inclusion. And we saw a 4-to-1 palatability response. As part of that overall pet equation, right? It really doesn't matter what's in the food if the pet won't eat it, right? Kind of like I tell my son, eat your green beans. Dad, I don't like green beans. Well, they're good for you. Eat your green beans. Well, I'm not going to eat my green beans. Then you find them rolled up in a napkin, right? We can't have that with our pets, right? There's not other choice, right? We're providing the entire meal for them. So that palatability is absolutely vital. And in our trials, our results also show great palatability.
I think you mentioned that was a cat study that you saw that palatability, right?
Right.
And just because that also speaks even more volumes, because getting cats to think something is palatable can be really hard. So I just want to acknowledge it's even bigger than it probably sounded initially. And then to go back to what you said on this product is a very small inclusion rate. 1% is really tiny. And I had mentioned earlier about when it came to a probiotic that sometimes you have to use large inclusions to get the same end result. So if you're able to get all these benefits at a pretty low inclusion, that can be great from a formulation perspective. One, because now you have more room in a formula to play with all the other things that have to be in a formula, but also it can potentially reduce cost as well to get all of these benefits. So just to acknowledge that is really helpful. I can speak from the formulation side of things and just working with clients on who have all these values. They want what's best for the pet, but they also, you know, they don't have they don't have endless number of money either. And right. Neither does the pet owner, right? We want what's best for our pet and something that we could hopefully afford, especially in today's economy. So that's also really important. And then you started getting into the research around cats, and I am very excited about that. I think sometimes cats get forgotten in some of our research. So was there anything else that you wanted to share around the research that you have found in cats?
Yeah, happy to. As you say, sometimes we think that cats are small dogs. They're not small dogs, right? And a lot of times we'll extrapolate data from dogs to cats, right? And so through our cat work, we absolutely can confirm they're not small dogs. Different metabolism, different preference, as you already mentioned, sometimes a lot more picky. Although I think some small dog owners would say also that they're pretty picky, but looking at the cat research that we did, we saw some of the same things that we've seen in dog amount of, around immunity, around that balanced immunity. But we saw some different responses when it comes to some of those gut health indicators. One of those, particularly as we've already mentioned, around butyrate. And what we saw was a response unlike what we see in dog response. So in dogs, when we've done our trials and done our research, we've seen an increase in fecal butyrate, right? So translate that to be okay. Intestines producing more butyrate, cells are using it, and we see that come out in the feces. Now, of course, with dogs and cats, that's what we have to measure, right? The end product. But in our cat work, we didn't see that. We didn't see that increase in fecal butyrate. So it puzzled us and we said, what's going on? So we backed up and we looked at the microbiome, right? And in our microbiome work, we track taxa, like certain families of microorganisms. The microbiome is extremely redundant and extremely resilient. So there might be 10 different bugs that produce butyrate. We want to track those. Okay. So we went back and we looked and we said, yeah, they're there. Okay. Are they active? Because just being there doesn't mean they're active, right? So then we looked at the genomics and said, yeah, they're there and they're active. So why are we seeing decreased fecal butyrate in cat, unlike dog? Okay, let's understand the difference between dogs and cats, right? Cats absolutely are more efficient butyrate utilizers. Now, you wouldn't think that in an obligate carnivore, but Mother Nature rules, right? So the bugs were there. They're turned on. It looks like cats are just more efficient at utilizing that. Would have missed that. Would absolutely have missed that had we extrapolated dog research into cat research. So again, highlighting the importance of do the work in the target species.
Let's recap that for our listeners. TrueMoon can help support a balanced immune system. Enthocor has some data to suggest that it can reduce breath odor, and both can be added in at low amounts in the formula. And remember, cats are not small dogs. So doing research in dogs and cats is a must.
Yes, exactly. As much as we do know about nutrition for cats and dogs, there's still a lot more to learn. Again, repeating, I think especially in cats, because cats are just very, very unique. They're very fascinating to me. They do because they have that carnivore nature, there are going to be different things about them that are just special when it comes to their nutrition. So hopefully we've gotten people understanding what postbiotics are, the benefits that they can bring cats and dogs. Now, when it comes to actually getting this into the marketplace, which is can be a challenge in a lot of different ways for a lot of different products, what have been some of your experiences, challenges, for getting these into the market, whether it's to work with other products to put them in or getting the communication? What has that been like?
Yeah, it's been good so far. I think it's part of an education journey. As we've now introduced the term postbiotics, what does that really mean? And how does that differ from the other biotics, right? So that education, that consumer understanding of this next evolution of biotic, right? Most likely got probiotics down pretty good, right? People understand that. Start to understand some of the prebiotic concepts, right? As you mentioned, the fibers. But now that next education step on postbiotics, how they differ, what's their advantage, it has been an education process. And I would say very well received, right? When you take the time to sit down and talk through what this is, very well received, and people start to understand that. I would say that we're still early in that education process. And then when we talk with manufacturers and customers about this, it always comes down to, okay, can I replace, right? Do I need all the other biotics in there? And so as we continue that work, we're looking to see what those synergies might be between postbiotics and prebiotics, for example. We're early in those stages of work to start to understand that. You can imagine all the trial work that we would need to do to look at all the possible combinations and permutations of that. And so we're early on in those stages to start to understand that, to see if we can drive synergistic effects. And when I refer to a synergistic effect, that's 1 + 1 = 3. So it's not just 1 + 1 = 2, but how do these things work together, or do they work together, right? So to have that understanding. But in general, I would say the reception that we've got has been positive, particularly when we are able to take people through the research and look at the depth of what we've looked at.
So I heard back from the most recent trade show in PET, that's Global Expo in Orlando, that when looking at some of the new products, we're starting to see more of that postbiotic term pop up. And I know that with True Moon and Epicor Pets, those are products available on the market, but it is more of a business to business. So they're being used by products inside of a bigger product. What has been some of your feedback from brands? And I guess they're seeing good things too, because if they're starting to utilize it in their marketing, that's a good sign. But what are some specific things that you've heard from brands?
Yeah, great question. Some of the feedback that we're hearing back from brands is they like the simplicity, right? They like knowing that if they include a postbiotic, they don't have to worry about variability, right? They don't have to worry about processing. That if they formulate it right, it's there every time. And take that together with the research results, they know it's going to be effective. And I think we're starting to see that recognition more and more.
I'm sure it does help in the marketing side of things, because it is a type of product that can really be used across your brand. Again, I'm thinking more on the formulation side of it. Postbiotics is something that we can use in dry pet food and wet pet food, treats and beyond, unlike a probiotic. So if you're having to think about your messaging on your packaging, that can be really complicated to be able to say something on one type of packaging, like your dry food, and not be able to say it on the same for your wet. So I can also see how it could be really nice for a marketing perspective, but also on a brand consistency perspective on either the formulation side or the research and development side. All right. Postbiotics, we've talked about this term. It's popping up more. Pet parents are going to see this more. Now, how do they know the difference between one postbiotic versus another? Because all that we've talked about is, you know, very specific research that you've done for these particular products. And back to what I said earlier about the label can be confusing to navigate, because it all has to say something the same. So if they see yeast fermentation product, how do they know if it's like a True Moon or Epicor or something else?
Yeah, fantastic point, Megan. So what we also offer our customers is the ability to trademark license, right? So basically that says, hey, if you agree to use the recommended inclusion rates in your food, we will co-brand with you, right? We will trademark license agreement. Now, what's the benefit there? When you do that, you get access to all of our research, right? And so we can even link that up, right, to make it really easy for the consumer to look at that. And so by agreeing to that, sort of the Cargill Inside technology, right, you get access to all the research trials that we've done, all the results, showing the benefits, and really helping build that consumer confidence in Cargill postbiotics. The brand doesn't have to use the trademark, right? If they want to build it on their own, that it offers that flexibility. Right? And we're happy to provide the research there.
Again, it goes back to the benefits of publishing your research is that it's available for everyone to benefit and use to support the benefits of this particular ingredient in this product. So I think that's fantastic. And before we close today, is there anything else that you would like to share or maybe make sure that people have one thing that they would take home from this?
The take-home message is really threefold here, right? First of all, that owner insights, that owner needs and desires for health products, right? To really hit the sweet spot of what owners are looking for around pet health, right? We sit squarely in that space, absolutely, with postbiotics, right? With the research that we've got, proving the health benefits that pet parents are really looking for, really provides us a nice place to be. And then the ease of applicability, right? So I don't have to worry about what process I'm going through. I don't have to worry about whether it's dry or wet or a treat application, right? As we talked a little bit about before, right? I can have that across my entire portfolio of products to deliver these benefits that pet parents are seeking.
If you want a little bit more pet innovation insights, as a bonus, we asked Lawrence for his thoughts around innovation for the pet industry.
There's a number of pieces from a Cargill European point of view. We're trying to give our European pet customers more reasons to work with Cargill. So we're a new player, and we're currently building some internal collaboration across all those existing pet product portfolio ingredients I mentioned earlier. And we've also recently acquired Delacon, and it will be really interesting if we can start to introduce plant phytogenics into the pet world and overcome some of those toxicity challenges. From a pet postbiotic point of view, we'll continue to invest and share in new published research. And from a wider pet innovation market perspective, this is a personal view, but I think it will be really interesting to see how the sustainability market trends play out between the current use of animal proteins from the human food chain versus the needs of a circular economy and the use of human byproducts alongside the entrance of alternative protein sources.
Congratulations, Mark and Lawrence. Cargill sure sounds like they have a lot going on, all the way from ingredients that can withstand harsh manufacturing conditions to company acquisitions. We look forward to seeing what the future holds for Cargill.
Thank you for joining us on the Pet Industry Podcast, a BSM Partners production. If you want to learn more about BSM Partners, please visit us at bsmpartners.net. Make sure you are subscribed to the podcast and share it with a friend. We want to thank our podcast team, Dr. Sydney McCauley, Kareen Harris, Ada Thomas, Michael Johnson, Dr. Stephanie Clark, and Leanne Haggerty, and our amazing editor, Cliff Dubinois.